Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Charles Hoskinson. He is the founder of Cardano, a third-generation cryptocurrency that is on fire of late. In the early days of Bitcoin, he was a proponent leading educational projects, and also he was one of the key people in founding Ethereum as well. He's a veteran to the crypto space, and I'm super excited to welcome Charles on the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you. I want to do a few things here. I want to help people get a generalized, bigger overview of why crypto, why decentralization, and then kind of go more into this angle of what's wrong or what are the limitations of the current major blockchains out there, and then how is Cardano kind of fixing those limitations, those problems, and lastly, we'll end up with some viewer questions that people have been asking. So first, why crypto and why decentralization? Like, what about this time in history allows for, you know, all of this to come together at this moment?
So everybody loves institutions and governments until they don't. And everybody loves corporations and trust Google with don't be evil and Facebook because it's the cool new thing until they don't. And the problem with the way that society is built and how power operates is that life lives and dies by the flows of trust, information, and value. So we have to trust each other at some point. You know, if you take medicine, you have to trust it's real. If you eat food, you have to trust it's not poisonous or expired. You know, if you hear something, you have to understand the veracity of that. So human beings, what we do is we construct companies, institutions, religions, concepts, whatever they might be, to help us navigate that world and ultimately push us in a way where society is stable. The point of cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology is that it accommodates for two things that we're not so good at managing right now. First, globalization. Well, you know, when we had the Westphalian state model, we have these countries, as long as like countries are siloed and China's China, America's America, Japan's Japan, it kind of works. But when you start talking about a global economy and global warming and global trade and all these transnational regulations, usually that only works on the back of an empire, where one empire comes in, conquers everybody else and says, okay, you're just going to follow the Roman standard or the British standard or the American standard. Now we're seeing the Chinese standard starting to emerge, especially in places like Africa and Central Asia. Okay, well, we don't want that. We would like to have global standards without the war or the empire. So the first thing that blockchain do really well is this concept of brokering trust amongst people who really don't trust each other, but they have to work together for some notion of a common good, a greater good. So that's kind of that first item. The other thing is that you have these collective demands of a global economy that transcend nation states. I travel, you travel. You know, I've been to 52 countries. We have coronavirus, for example, where how do you get rid of that? Well, it's not just about vaccinating your country. As we saw, even if your whole country is vaccinated, you'll still have lots of cases because it'll mutate somewhere else and then come back every season. The flu does this. So it's a global problem. So how do you deal with global governance and global problems and these other things? Again, you come back to, are we going to have an empire or are we going to have some sort of transnational agreement? But what keeps people honest? How do you make sure that people don't cheat or screw each other? So the idea of a third option, instead of having something completely private or something completely public, you have some companion that piggybacks with the private and public systems that sorts out and creates a record of account. It's immutable, it's timestamped, it's auditable. It brokers trust amongst all these entities. And with smart contracts, logic, contractual relationships, the flow of value and so forth is a super powerful thing. And it's something that we've never had before in human history. And the thing is, it's no longer optional. With the advent of the internet, the genie's out of the bottle, information now flows instantaneously. And it's really disrupting society in positive and negative ways. And from the flow of fake news and propaganda to the flow of great knowledge and open textbooks and MOOCs and these things, you get a lot of good with your bad. And societies aren't built to handle that. So that's another dimension of it. Is in a world where information moves instantly, how do you make identity move instantly, conference move instantly, value move instantly? And how do we get to a financial stem cell? That's the last point I'll mention. And that is basically saying, well, instead of looking at something as a commodity or a currency or a stock or something like that, why don't we have something more primitive that can be all things just based upon how you need it? So it can wake up one day and be a security, like a stock. It can wake up another day and be backed by a commodity. It can wake up another day and be backed by a currency. And it's universal and trades everywhere, not in these little silos and these individual markets. Like you have to go to New York to do something or Toronto to do something. You can be in Senegal and have equivalent market access to the person in New York or London. And that's just a much more fair way of running the world. So it's the missing pieces of the promise of globalization and the internet, and a kind of hope where we can build a system where everybody's treated fairly from Bill Gates down to the shepherd in Senegal. And I really look forward to that.
It's interesting you're talking about brokering trust between, let's say, parties that don't trust each other. Typically, let's say in financial transactions, you would need a third party like a bank or a financial system in order to broker trust between those two parties that don't trust each other. A couple weeks ago, I had Robert Leshner from Compound on, and he kind of shared the whole kind of decentralized finance angle of what's going on with lending and borrowing. And so I understand, I see this kind of with financial transactions, how it's taking off, kind of this brokering of trust, and it's removing the inefficiencies, let's say, of the traditional financial system. But do you see this carrying on beyond the financial system? Because you're talking about globalization, governance, governments, like how far does this go?
Oh, I mean, anywhere you have an institution, you have a potential of disrupting that institution in part or completely with this technology. So, for example, United States, half of my country believes the election was fraudulent. If it is or not, doesn't matter. The belief that it is causes huge issues to the legitimacy of elections. So that institution is damaged and it has to be repaired somehow through some magic. And it's the same with anti-vaxxers. It's the same with all this stuff. That's a failure of institutional trust, where the things we believe are there to provide oversight, auditability, and make sure that that's fair and functioning well. Some group of people no longer believe it's functioning properly with or without justification. So you can use these systems for property, voting. You can use these systems for identity management. You can use these systems for supply chains. And it can be as pervasive as you go to the supermarket and you see a label that says GMO free organic, and you can scan a QR code and actually see the chain of custody of where it came from and who signed that and who's putting their reputation on the line that it indeed is. So any place there's institutional trust, if those institutions are weakened or no longer trusted, or it's difficult to assess them because they're foreign institutions, like for example, do you trust the government of Tanzania for your beef? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But what if you're not so familiar with it? Where do you sit in when they say that that's safe beef or something like that? And maybe they're doing a great job, but because their brand isn't so good, people just simply won't buy it. For example, we do a lot of work with the government of Georgia over in Eastern Europe, and they invented wine. Like the first vineyards came from Georgia. There's over 5,000 vineyards in this tiny country. You go there, you drink the wine, it's the best wine you've ever had in your life. But nobody buys it because they don't think it's of the same quality as Italian wine or French wine and so forth. So just being able to change that global perception in a way that is new and different than an institutional trust is a very valuable thing. And that's actually at the center of cryptocurrencies. It just so happened that the killer app of blockchain to begin with money, it's kind of like email to the internet, got the ball rolling, but by no means is it the end of the story.
Would you say, let's say between with brokering trust between two parties, let's say that don't trust each other, you have banks that are largely inefficient compared to what, let's say, decentralized, blockchain can do. Would you say governments also would fit into this kind of inefficient category? And is efficiency the right angle to look at kind of what the potential of blockchain can do in terms of brokering trust? Or are there other angles that you think are helpful to look at it as?
So what you want to do is get rid of middlemen of necessity and replace them with middlemen of value. I think that should be the target for all things that you do. So there's too many things in life where there's somebody who's in the transaction that you really don't want to be there, but is there either because they own the protocol or because of some enumerated power. Like for example, if you look at Uber, Airbnb, eBay, all these multi-sided markets, all they do is bring people together. they're not actually responsible for the delivery of the service or the consumption of the service or product. They're just bringing people together, and they take a huge amount of the transaction as a consequence. That's a middleman of necessity. Now, a middleman of value is where you invite someone into a transaction to make things a little bit easier for you. Those could be escrows and custodians. Those can be lawyers. Those can be other parties. And their job is to basically reduce risk, improve compliance, or perhaps optimize the value that's sitting on the table. So we need to move to a world where our institutions and systems basically facilitate that, instead of allowing monopolies to form around middlemen of necessity. Social media is a great example of this. Twitter controls both the protocol and the interface to the protocol. So it's like owning the boat and the river. And as a consequence, they say, not only do we get to decide who gets to sail on our boat, we get to decide which boats get to sail on the river altogether. If you separated the two, Twitter, the website, could have a blockchain or cryptocurrency backend. And then that backend could also plug into Facebook, and it could plug into LinkedIn or to our social network or whatever. And as a consequence, you could then say, well, maybe you don't get to sail on the Twitter boat, but somebody else can have access to that free reign. So this is where we need to move, is get rid of those middlemen who control vital resources, whether it be the flow of information, your identity, your reputation, the flow of your money. For example, banking services are a huge issue. What happens if you're in an industry that banks don't like or consider to be too high risk? Even if it's a regulated, completely legitimate industry in your jurisdiction, if the bank doesn't like it, you can't really do business. We see this a lot in America, in Colorado, with the marijuana and CBD industry. The state has passed a law saying that not only is it okay, it's regulated. They generate billions of dollars of tax money, and almost every single one of them are unbanked because the banks have decided they just can't service them. That's an example of the interface, but who also happened to be controlling the protocol. Now, if the protocol was open, then people could build on and off ramps specifically for those domains, and suddenly they would be banked and all that economic activity would be available to society. You see, so that's, mm-hmm. that's I think, the key way of looking at that, and it provides a lot of clarity.
Can you give an example? For example, when you look at a company like Airbnb and the service they provide, how would it be offered in a decentralized, let's say, blockchain type of approach?
So first, you would need to have a payment system. That's one of the things Airbnb does. So how do you get value between the actors? Second, you need an identity system. So how do you identify the actors? And then third, you need some sort of oversight and reputation system. So the point there is that each of those could form into a free market. And instead of having a monopolistic provider that does all of that in the stack, you would then have markets form where multiple providers in who are regional with various reputations would basically provide that. And actually, they would open up to a lot of small businesses. So regional hotels, for example, they might actually get involved in the business of audit and oversight and assist in the operation of these things to build that trust. But so cryptocurrency can do the identity side very well. You can store identities with DIDs or other things on chain. The payment system can also be accommodated. You can have stablecoin or CBDC or something like that to facilitate those transactions. And you're removing a huge amount of the issues. It also can act as the smart contract side for an escrow. So you can put stuff there, you can have an insurance market there. And it's not like saying you don't have third parties, but what happens is you, the consumer, and you, the provider, are inviting those third parties into the transaction to de-risk the transaction or to augment the transaction to be more valuable for everybody. With the existing systems, they're monopolies. They basically say we own the whole network effect and all the user base. So whatever the terms of service happen to be, whether they're convenient to you or not, you must accept them if you want access to that entire market. Great mm-hmm. example would be Uber, where every year it becomes less and less profitable mm-hmm. for an Uber driver, but they can't say no because they lose access to that entire customer base. In normal world, when you have competition and proper service providers, if Amazon, for example, with web services becomes problematic, you move to Rackspace or to Azure or to some other hosting infrastructure because mm-hmm. they offer you a better deal. Or maybe you self-host and go to Dell and buy some hardware or something like that. You can't do that with Uber. It's all or nothing, take our entire stack or not. And you can't break parts of the stack off and decentralize those parts of the stack and let a free market form. And this is a dangerous thing in society, because not only is that happening, but then also you have collusion. where these small group of monopolistic actors are getting together and they're preventing people from competing with them under various labels. Like Parler is a great example of that, where they say, oh, you know, say, if you don't like Twitter, compete with Twitter. Oh, okay. So they created a competing platform. And then Google and Apple and Amazon got together and universally deplatformed this competitor. So now it's no longer the case that you can even compete. There's only one way of doing things, and that's it. And they'll just cow themselves in whatever EULA to justify that monopolistic action. We saw that in the 19th century. It was called Standard Oil, and it did not work out so well. We saw that in the 1990s. It was called Microsoft, as they went and dominated and destroyed competition and hurt the entire tech industry. And you saw the death of Netscape and other such things. It was just bad for the web then, and this type of behavior is bad for all of us now.
Mm-hmm. Can you share a bit about your background? How did you get interested in cryptography? I hear you have a background with math. Mm-hmm. Did that help you kind of understand kind of the first kind of iteration of Bitcoin, and how did you kind of run across that, and what was the story behind it?
Yeah, there was kind of three converging forces there. One, I studied mathematics, and I actually wanted to be a math professor, but the field is so dreary. You know, it's like you have to be a special kind of crazy to become a professional mathematician. And it's not just intellectually you have to be there. You have to have this amazing tolerance for bureaucracy, this amazing tolerance to work on problems that are utterly uninteresting, to build an academic career, and so forth. And I said, I don't really want to spend the next 10, 20 years being postdoc and then tenure track professor, getting to a point where I can finally work on problems that I'm interested in. Because I was interested in problems you can't solve, like Collatz conjecture and Goldbach conjecture. And you can't really publish much about these problems because they're basically unsolvable. And every now and then you get lucky and you know, get the Fields Medal, but that's like saying you win the lottery or something like that. It just doesn't happen. So that means while you're waiting to get tenure, so then you can actually think about those things, you have to go and do a whole bunch of other things that are not so meaningful. And I didn't like academic politics or any of these types of things. I thought the whole system was like an ego engine as opposed to something that was useful. So I was lost. And at the same time, I was kind of a political firebrand. It's a very libertarian anarchist. And I liked monetary policy, like Austrian economics. And I was kind of a gold bug. I was part of the Ron Paul movement. So that kind of stuff, it really pushes you on the fringes. And then the other convergence is that I really enjoyed peer-to-peer software and open source software and the Floss movement. I was a big fan of that. And so it's kind of a little bit of a cypherpunk, a little bit of a Austrian. And I had enough analytic and technical skills that I could program and read papers and these types of things. So I was in a position where something like Bitcoin was accessible to me in the early days. In fact, the first time I heard about it, I think it was about 2010. I think it was the Slashdot revolution, where there was an article on Slashdot or something about Bitcoin. It was the white paper. And I read it and I said, oh, that's pretty interesting. It'll never work because it's a chicken the egg situation. You have to get to a certain network effect before the thing gets stable, but there's no reason for it to be stable and get to that network effect until you're there. So, you know, it's like when you make it, you make it. You get to a certain level of fame, you never go broke because you can always leverage your fame to make money. Well, it's the same for Bitcoin. So I mined a lot and it was easy to do. You know, I had a Crossfire set up with some 5850 AMD cards, and I think I had 1.2 giga hashes, which was a lot back in that day. And then I bought a lot, and I, you know, like would buy things with Bitcoin on Bitmint and these other places. And I thought nothing of it. I have a $4 million Xbox 360 that I can't ever give away. I'm just like, I paid a lot of Bitcoin for this thing and I'm never going to give it away because of it. So I have that, you know, and then right around 2013 is when Bitcoin started getting big. It was right after the Cyprus incident. And it got up to like $250. And I said, wow, okay, it has that network effect now. It's not going to go away. So I created a free course to educate people. It's called Bitcoin or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Crypto. And I got tens of thousands of students. I think it's at 70 or 80,000 now. And then one of my students happened to be a Chinese investor. And I thought it was like a Nigerian prince scam. He reached out to me and said, I'd like to give you $500,000 to start something. I was like, yeah, sure. You got some land you want to sell me too, don't you? He's like, no, I'm serious. And I was like, oh, okay. So we talked and we negotiated. And I started a series of companies. And what I'm most known for is Ethereum. But the thing I've actually done the most work on and had the most professional successes is my current company, IO Global. We've been around for 6 years. We have 300 people. You know, we did Cardano. We work on multiple cryptocurrencies. We have the largest cryptocurrency research group in the world. We've written 95 papers, over 10,000 citations. Over half have been peer-reviewed at major venues. So it's been the joy of my life the last 6 years, just doing that, being there, and being part of this industry in that respect.
Mm-hmm. I watched a TED talk you did in 2014 where you talked about the need for decentralization, but linked it to Africa, the need for economic identity. It seemed back then in 2014, your ideas of the impact of cryptocurrency with the underdeveloped world, you saw the potential very, very clearly back then. I'm just curious, where did that come from? Did that predate your interest in Bitcoin, or was that something that arose after your interest in Bitcoin?
Well, I read Mohamed Yunus's book, Banking the Poor. And, you know, when you're in academia, you tend to meet a lot of people who are foreign students. And so I knew African students who came into grad school from Africa, or I knew people from Asia who came from really poor countries, like destitute family in Thailand and things like that. You know, you live off graduate stipend, they pay $1,000 a month. And these students would send home 500 of that and find a way to live on the other 500. And then they pay these huge remittance fees, like to send money to Thailand, $150 would be taken out of the transaction to get the money home after the movement of the money and the Forex was taken into play. And I just thought that was horrendously unfair, that so much from people who have so little is taken just for them to live. And I say, well, there's no reason for that. We have a modern society and modern systems. So it made sense to me that the things we were building could have the ability to solve that problem. It was kind of like Norman Borlaug, you know, he didn't set out to be a humanitarian. He just realized that there was all this advancements in agricultural technology. And if he went around teaching people how to just use fertilizer properly, you probably would quadruple yields. And this is exactly what happened. And it turned out that he ended up saving over his career over 1 billion lives from people who didn't starve to death because he upgraded farms. And that was just a better system and better technology. And one guy did that. So I thought, well, cryptocurrencies could be the exact same thing. If you teach people how to use these things and build on these things, then they're just going to go build their own systems because no one likes being screwed. And people will just use them. You know, necessity is the mother of all invention. So back in 2014, I thought that was the killer use case for Ethereum, not unicorns and rainbows and, you know, all this other crap. But I said, no, it's going to be peer-to-peer lending. It's going to be, you know, property registration, voting. It's systems. And you have protocols that you can deploy the systems on, and they're open, and no one can shut you out. And in the age of social credit and all these other things, it just made so much sense to me to have something like that.
Mm-hmm. With Bitcoin, what do you think is kind of the secret to its success? Like, why was it able to break out of this kind of relatively unknown, the chicken and egg problem, and why has it kind of become what it has become over the years?
Well, first there was this beautiful video game aspect of Bitcoin where you go and do something on your computer and you get something. So anytime you have a feedback loop of labor reward, that's a very powerful thing. And there's a whole field that studies that. It's called gamification. So the mechanism design was great. The way that Bitcoin was designed as a game was really cool. Second, there was the right society for it. You know, the cypherpunk movement had been thinking about cryptocurrencies, digital currencies for 30 years, you know, from Nick Szabo and David Chaum and Hal Finney and these other guys and Adam Back. They were doing all these things like DigiCash and Bcash and BitGold. So there was a pre-built community that was very like, fuck the system, anti government type of a deal, and they wanted to have their own money. And this was like, hey, it's going to be email for money, it's money for the internet. It just made sense. So there was a game you could play, there was rules where you could, you know, win, and you could go and build your own money. And then the other thing is that people started realizing that no matter what happens, just capital controls alone will probably give this thing some value. That's why the Chinese really loved it back in the early days. They were like, how do we get money out of China? Oh, this Bitcoin thing is really interesting. You know, so that alone creates an organic utility and use and demand for it that would always give it some value. And then what happened was that it started becoming successful because it was successful, and more people came in, and we just saw wave after wave after wave. So it's just there's going to be a thousand papers and books and other things that people write with the benefit of hindsight that say, well, this is why the Bitcoin miracle happened. But why Bitcoin over DigiCash or over BitGold or any of these other projects? It was just one of those right place, right time things and the right community. And of course, with all successful things, the minute you have a successful thing, it seldom is the thing that ends up being around forever. You know, like Mosaic was a great web browser for the time, but obviously it's no longer with us because people realized there was so much more to do. Well, we created Ethereum, not because someone told us to, we created it because we were frustrated with Bitcoin. You know, we were like doing color coins and Mastercoin and all these other projects on top of Bitcoin, just trying to get Bitcoin to do useful things. And it was like being dragged through a swamp full of razor blades. It was a horrible process. We said, screw it. Let's create a programming language to go with a blockchain, just like when JavaScript came to the browser. And then why did I create Cardano? I created Cardano because Ethereum, in my view, is not going to be able to meet the challenges of a global scale system. So we went and did that. So necessity is the mother of invention in that respect. And the testimony to Bitcoin is its ability to inspire people to go and do stuff. Successful projects always do that, whether it be Linux or BitTorrent or whatever. It provides real clear utility. It sells you a vision. And once you've been indoctrinated with that vision, you can't go back. You know, the genie's out of the bottle. You've left the cave of Plato. And now you kind of realize what the real world is. And you say, screw it, we're going to go and, you know, go do this now. And I might not agree with the way you've done it, but I now understand these concepts and it makes no sense to go back to the old concepts.
Mm-hmm. What's your take on the cult of Satoshi, or this whole phenomenon of almost bordering religious fanaticism about Bitcoin, but also those who might view Bitcoin as like the only or the premier, the forever, you know, cryptocurrency. What are your thoughts?
Whoever is the prophet who leads people out of the cave usually gets his own religion. So, you know, Satoshi got one. And of course, like all true deities, he's dead. You know, Satoshi's alias is gone and it's buried. And even if Satoshi was to return, there's no way to convince people that that person's Satoshi. Like if you sign with the PGP key, people be, oh, well, you stole it or you hacked it or something. Hey, you know, Lenstra's research has gotten to the point where we could break a 1K RSA keys, aha, you know, clever guy, or something like that. All right, no one actually will believe you're the prophet after the prophet has ascended into the heavens. So it makes perfect sense. And it's just people who need hope. When you lose faith in institutions and governments, you need to find faith somewhere. And so they've traded faith in government or religion or whatever to faith in code and faith in that culture. And they believe if only there are a good enough prophet, they're a good enough cleric, they're good enough priest of the cult of Satoshi, then they shall be rewarded. In this particular case, it's with wealth and power and being part of this new economic order. So that maximalism is predictable and it's extremely harmful to the project as a whole, because the reality was the project was pedagogical. You know, the whole point of it was supposed to demonstrate that you could have decentralized value. You could teleport it around the world and to get people into the mindset of, well, what else can you do? And go and do the next thing. It was never intended to become a religion, but it became one because humans are humans. It's almost like the Warhammer 40K universe with the God Emperor. You know, when he was living in the universe, he was like this secular guy, and he said, "Venerate, but don't worship me." Then the first thing everybody did after he got constrained to the Golden Throne is everybody started worshiping him, the corpse god. And it's exactly what's happened with Satoshi. He's become the God Emperor of the 40K universe. You know, people venerate this corpse god and so forth. But you know, it is what it is. And unfortunately, it has infected some people to a point where they have become exceedingly toxic. You know, anyone who does anything, Ethereum, whatever, it's a shit coin. It's a bad deal. It's like, we've just brought all these people into the cryptocurrency space. No, it doesn't matter. It's a shit coin. But there's only one truth, Bitcoin. You know, we spent 6 years researching proof of stake stuff for Cardano. And, you know, we have a much better protocol in our view. It's been peer reviewed by major academics and major institutions. They say, oh, no, it doesn't work. It can't work. It doesn't follow the vision of Satoshi. That's no longer a rational conversation. It's religious extremism in that respect. And human beings have a tendency to do that. And if you want a great historical analysis of it, read Yuval Harari, his Sapiens book and his follow-on book, Homo Deus. And it gives you a sense of what humans tend to do over the arc of history.
Mm-hmm. What's your take? I know you've commented on Bitcoin as, you know, it's become this protocol where it's been hard to innovate, hard to get agreements, hard to really push the envelope on new technologies. And that's part of the frustration on starting, let's say, Ethereum or Cardano. What's your future prognosis of where Bitcoin is headed? Are you super optimistic that Bitcoin just remains the preeminent kind of store of value in the crypto world? Or do you have any kind of skepticism or doubt, let's say 10 or 20 years down the road?
Bitcoin is only valuable because it's valuable. It has no technological advantage. It's actually the least advanced of all the cryptocurrencies. And leech feature risk, there's no reason for it other than the fact that it exists. And if the value plummets, no one will mine it, and then you lose all your security. So the minute that it gets flipped by another cryptocurrency, unless they can find a way to actually innovate again, Bitcoin will die, in my view, because there's no reason to hold it over its neighbors. This is one of the reasons why we work so hard with Cardano in particular at trying to build a proper governance system, because you don't want a situation every time you want to do an innovation, you end up with a Cardano Classic or Cardano Cash or these types of things. Bitcoin lost some of its earliest and best people over just the block size, a system parameter. It just tells you, if you can't even agree on something so trivial as a block size, then how do you get post-quantum crypto when quantum computers come? How do you get smart contracts? How do you get, you know, new ways of structuring the network stack? How do you move from a replicated model to a decentralized model? How do you throw data away? What happens when the Bitcoin blockchain is a petabyte and only two people can have it, as NSA and Google? So what do you do with that? You know, and if you can't decide a block size, how the hell do you decide these much more significant and serious things? You need a governance system that sits on top of it. And unfortunately, that's so far beyond the initial vision of Satoshi. That's like going to a bunch of Jews and trying to convince them that, you know, Jesus Christ is their savior. You have a whole new religion, okay? You're not really going to succeed in that respect. It is what it is. You have to accept that these things coexist. So what usually happens is that when the evolutionary and competitive dynamics of the system are counterproductive to growth beyond a certain point, the system will stall, and then 1,000 flowers will bloom. The vast majority of them will wilt, but some of them will become a mighty oak, and they will replace the old system, and it will assume all the, absorb all the goodness of that system, but not carry the bad characteristics of it. Mm-hmm. So you'll still have the blockchain component. You'll still have it be able to settle transactions the way Bitcoin does. The email for money thing will be there, but then you'll have smart contracts and governance and interoperability and much faster capabilities and the ability to be global scale and work really well on a cell phone and have privacy and rah, 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 all these additional features and functionality. And if that doesn't happen, one of the other 1,000 flowers will have that, and then eventually they'll meet in the middle and kind of merge together and, you know, get to the next system and so forth. It's a very Darwinian system in that mm-hmm. respect, and that's a great thing for everybody.
Mm-hmm. What would you say would be your key insight in terms of crypto and why you started Cardano over the years? I mean, it sounds like I've watched a ton of your videos over the past week or two, and it seems like part of your focus is you really are trying to make something scalable, something that isn't limited by poor governance or by poor structure or by a poor system. You're really trying to make a crypto, a blockchain for the future, something that really can be everything that a blockchain should be. Where is that coming from? And is that perhaps what separates Cardano from other cryptos? Is that focus on really trying to achieve kind of this ideal in as best to your guys' ability, right? A blockchain that can scale in the future?
Yeah, I mean, the mission was always, how do we get economic identity to the billions of people who don't have it? Well, you build them a financial operating system that can handle their identity, their value, and give them a governance stack, so you don't need central actors to run everything. So when you actually follow that through logically, you say, well, hang on a second here. I have to build a system with billions of users, but no Microsoft or Apple or Google. Holy moly, that's hard. So we said, well, the first thing we have to solve is this idea that you bring more than you take. So, you know, imagine like a potluck or, you know, like something like that, where normally when you go to meet some family and friends, you would bring some food with you, and ideally you'd bring as much or more food than the food you eat. So no matter how many people show up, there's always enough for people to eat. Right now, with all cryptocurrencies, it's the same amount of food. You're just adding more chairs around the table. So the more people who show up, the less food for everybody. That's not a sustainable system. And you're not going to get to the scale of millions to billions of users, like we see with Ethereum right now in the gargantuan transaction fees. You move a dollar, you have to spend $50. It's crazy. And that's by design. It's not a bug or something. It's just how those protocols work. So building truly scalable protocols is a super hard thing, because you have to admit adversaries, and you also have to admit that there's no centralized actor to optimize things. So we spent 6 years and 95 papers and lots of academic work to try to figure out what's possible and what's impossible. And a lot of it is a bit translating these massive systems that Google has built and others have built, and asking, okay, well, how do we get what they've done but not have Google? You know, these types of things. The other side of it is that once you have billions of people, they have to get along. So you need a management system to be able to kind of allow them to express themselves and vote, and also pay for stuff as the system wants to upgrade. So you need a treasury system, you need a voting system, you need a governance system, a way of doing hard forks and so forth, because it's not going to work. You'll get to a certain point, like Bitcoin, where it's impossible to evolve behind a certain point. So you're just another checkpoint at that point, and then people leave you behind when the next generation comes out and then you're gone. And then finally, there are 8,000 cryptocurrencies. There's hundreds of legacy financial systems. You need to be interoperable. You need to have the ability to talk to all those systems. Could you imagine Wi-Fi, if Wi-Fi was only constrained to the manufacturer? So like your Apple phone can only connect to an Apple router. Your Google phone can only connect to a Google router. Oh, it just wouldn't work. I mean, there's nothing humans agree on, but Wi-Fi is the one true religion. You can be in North Korea, you could be in Iran, you could be in Israel, you can be in Japan, South Korea, China, Russia, and the United States, and your phone can connect to the Wi-Fi in all those countries. It's truly extraordinary when you think about that geopolitically, that's the one true faith of humanity, that and Bluetooth that we've gotten. So you kind of need a Wi-Fi Bluetooth moment in finance, and you need something where, regardless of what system you happen to live in, there's a way for your thing to talk to their things. And there's a bridge for that. So whatever the third generation of cryptocurrencies happen to be, it has to do those three things. Your users have to produce as much as they consume so you can sustainably grow to billions. You have to have a Wi-Fi moment where everything just works. And you have to have a governance system that means that when you get to that scale, you don't fragment apart and break apart into 1,000 pieces, or get to a certain point where you just simply can't grow anymore because the firm is too big, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And so we said, let's go do that. And if we do that well, then I'm going to have the cheapest, bestest protocol in the world for economic identity. And I could tangibly go to Ethiopia and all these places and say, hey, how do we get microfinance and microinsurance and these other things to run? It just so happens that that's also the best protocol for America and for the European Union and for China and for other places. And it's open protocol. So rent-seeking people seeking profit will build on that system. So I get to have my cake and eat it too. I get to go and do my life mission and, you know, go and play around in Africa and Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia. But then other people get to use the exact same infrastructure to do their stuff. And a lot of that stuff will be Fortune 500 companies and so forth. And their success is my success. The things they build, I get to use. The things I build, they get to use. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. You talk about third generation crypto, mm-hmm. and first generation being Bitcoin, largely as a store of value, proof of work, and then second generation being Ethereum with smart contracts, but Ethereum kind of experiencing some limitations of scalability, right. and cost. And then in previous talks, you've shared kind of how, you know, Polkadot might be kind of something that what Ethereum could have been, or, you know, in right. some ways, but Cardano is more what Bitcoin could have been or should have been, in a sense. Can you kind of explain kind of those thought processes?
Yeah. So first with Polkadot, had Gavin Wood stayed as CTO of Ethereum, then, you know, they probably would have upgraded ETH to ETH2 as ETH2 of Polkadot, and that would have been like a generation 2.5. It wasn't quite as ambitious as ETH2, but it runs. It's actually quite a very practical system, and there's a lot of magic to it. And it does a lot for their ecosystem. So if that alone would give them another 2-3 years to kind of think around and say, how do we get to the next level? Now, the thing about Cardano was that we didn't have the luxury of even Ethereum, because it hadn't launched when we started working on Cardano. They were just starting to get there. They had some test nets. And I had the original vision of Ethereum from when I was CEO there. And so I had kind of that to start with. But we started from first principles, and we started from all the way back to, you know, distributed systems stuff in the 1980s, and we kind of worked our way forward. So we wrote a paper defining what is a blockchain. It's called the GKL model. It's one of the most cited papers in the cryptocurrency space, over 900 citations, and it just defines, here's what a secure ledger is. And then we looked at a lot of things like the accounting model of Ethereum versus the accounting model of Bitcoin. And what we realized was that Satoshi actually did a lot of stuff right, but there was obvious places where the team or person who built Bitcoin had holes in their computer science knowledge. Because, you know, no one is an expert everywhere. So there were places where we could massively improve what Satoshi had done, and we could achieve the same or more of what Ethereum was trying to do, and do it in a way that we felt had a longer time horizon, more viability over a longer arc of time. Like the greatest example of that is the accounting model. So Bitcoin has something called UTXO, and Ethereum has something called counts. Well, the problem with the counts model is everybody in the whole system has to kind of know each other's business with it. And so there's this concept of a global state. With UTXO, you don't really care about the global state. You just have to care about your part of the graph. And then that, as long as you have that, you're okay. So if you're talking about sharding, talking about going from replicated to distributed, that's a much more graceful system to distribute. The problem with UTXO is it's not built for smart contracts. So we said, well, could we extend UTXO to have smart contracts? And we thought about it, Blockstream thought about it with a project called Simplicity, and then some Italian researchers created something called BitML. And so there was really a lot of good ideas, and we formalized the whole thing 2 years ago with the extended UTXO paper that we published and submitted to, I think it was ICFP. So that alone meant that we could take what Bitcoin had achieved and then suddenly have smart contracts with it, and suddenly have a lot more security properties, better way of figuring out resource costs, easier time sharding. And actually, we have some hard data on the comparison of these two things. So there's a famous researcher at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. His name is Pramod Viswanath. And he wrote this paper called Prism. And it's a sharded proof of work protocol. And he decided to run it on Ethereum and decided to run it on Bitcoin. So the optimizations he did for Bitcoin allowed him to be 10,000 times faster than Bitcoin. The optimizations he did for Ethereum, he was only to be able to be 100 times faster. So the UTXO model is just much easier to deal with in that respect. And there's a lot of that in there. And there's just a lot of goodness in the Bitcoin model. Like the design of Ouroboros, for example, our consensus algorithm, we really like the probabilistic finality of proof of work. We didn't want to go with a BFT protocol like Algorand did, or Cosmos did, or these other guys. We said, let's keep to what Satoshi did, have confirmations and these types of things. We feel it's a much more graceful system. It's just, it's 4 million times more energy efficient. And it gets more energy efficient over time, whereas Bitcoin, as it goes up in price, gets less energy efficient and so forth. So we fixed the broken windows. And then what we did is we tried to extend it to the next generation. And we did things that Satoshi probably would have done if he had the luxury of hindsight. In other areas, we radically diverged. Like, for example, with governance on chain, Satoshi wasn't a fan of that with the writing that he had. And we said, no, that's something that really does need to be done. And it's just us and Tezos right now who are really pushing that concept. And I guess Dash has done some really good work as well. But it's not something you do lighthearted. It's actually a harder problem than sharding or scale or these other things, because you're dealing with people. When you deal with protocols and algorithms, no matter how hard they are, they're math. Eventually, you can get to a point where they work. When you deal with people, people aren't rational. They're subject to whims and wills, and they elect a Trump, and they do all kinds of crazy stuff. And so you have to kind of protect the system from itself.
Yeah. I notice in a lot of your thinking and in what you guys are doing with Cardano, you are factoring in human behavior a lot and systems thinking and incentives, and you're really marrying technology together with the human kind of aspect. A lot of times I think that's hard for most people to do, to bring those two things together, like the science and humanities, you know, the technology and liberal arts, just the psychology of humans and, let's say, cryptography and code. Is there anything that helps you to do that, to bring all that together? Is it natural? I guess, is there something that is in your background that you've picked up on that makes you, you know, more prone to include that?
I mean, there's a whole field that studies this. Complex systems is what the field is called. And there's great academic organizations like the Santa Fe Institute, for example. And they're just an amazing org. And there's great books, like Scott Page wrote a book called Complex Adaptive Systems. And so given that there's 30 years of history in a whole lot of academic domain that says exactly that, how do you build complex systems from simple rules and the interactions of those rules? And they can be markets, they can be sand dunes, they can be voting behaviors, and there's all kinds of cool models you can look at. So once you go down the complexity road, there's so much you can gain from that analysis and that inquiry. And it's completely virgin territory for the cryptocurrency space. It's almost as if they don't even know that this field exists. So that's a huge unending series of inspiration. And we do have some people who that's what they got their PhD in, and we talk to them. And there's a lot of practical experiments that you can run and do. And as we grow larger, that's the body of literature and the body of protocol design that we really look deeply into. You know, it could be everything from how do you rebalance transaction fees to what's the optimal amount of stake pools in your system to, you know, how much should you be paying for security? Are you underpaying or overpaying? You know, these types of things. And also, you know, with voting, if you have voting, how do you actually get rid of rational ignorance? So rational ignorance is where the value of the knowledge is less than the time it takes to acquire it. So for example, I could become an expert on Peruvian cuisine and spend thousands of hours learning how to cook every dish and do all these things. But given that I don't really have a strong network there, I don't think that unless it's a passion project, the knowledge acquisition cost is more than the value of the Peruvian cuisine style. So I say rationally ignorant to that. Well, voting is the same way. You can learn everything about Medicare and Social Security and foreign policy, but your vote counts exactly the same as the crazy guy who's like, I like his hair. So why would you spend all this time to learn all those things? Instead, you just stay rationally ignorant. So you have to incentivize voting in the right way where people actually make meaningful votes and participate in a meaningful way. So systems design is super important. And as I mentioned, we have people who do that. Like, for example, we have an algorithmic game theorist named Elias Kasupas. He's at Oxford. This is all he does. You know, he just thinks every day, like, why do people do what they do? And how do I use systems to get them to do the things we want them to do?
Mm-hmm. I notice with what you're doing with Cardano, you're using a lot of peer review or papers, and you mentioned over almost 100 so far. And it seems like a very unique approach that you guys have taken where you've placed a lot of priority. I mean, it's not easy, right, to get these papers published and reviewed. And what's the point? Like, why did you place such a high priority on peer-reviewed papers? Is it the access you get to the sharp minds? Is it kind of preventing holes that you might be just not aware of, you know, in the system? Like, what's the bigger picture of why you've placed so much priority in peer-reviewed papers?
So the first thing you have to learn is smart people are the best people in the world at lying to you. You know, dumb people, they only have so much depth in their ability to deceive themselves and you. Smart people, they have so much more depth in their lives. So you need the smarter the people you have and the more qualified the people you have, stronger checks and balances, equally smart people on the other side to really probe them and make sure they're 100% sure that that's right. The peer review process was basically over the last 400 years designed to do that. Now, the advantage we have in computer science land is that computer science is one of the newest fields of science, of the hard sciences. Physics has been around for a long time. Biology has been around for a long time. Math, 5,000 years of history. Computer science, it's just the 20th century. So it actually has a conference instead of a journal peer review system, which means you do things in weeks and months that normally would take years and decades to do in the older sciences. So it just so happened that we could adopt a peer review system, and it doesn't actually super slow us down. It's more of a nice waypoint to get some things. The other nice part about it is that independent people of the project, when they say, how do you know Cardano works? Here's what happens when you meet these cryptocurrency founders. A lot of, they're all brilliant people, and they give you a paper and they say, look at all the math, look at the code, look at this. And you're like, okay. Like, are you a computer scientist? Are you a mathematician? Can you actually read the paper? Most people can't. 99.9% of people can't. They're just symbols on paper. So how do you know it works? You have faith in Bob or Bill or Jim or Jane that they actually did their homework and did it right. So what does that mean? You've developed a cult of personality around a founder, and you hope to God that cult is not going to lead you down to the realm of Stalin. You hope it's a beneficent dictator. And you know what? The more power you give an individual, the worse it is for everybody. So one thing that was super important to me is I said, we need to have checks and balances that said even the guy who started it is not above it and is constrained by some behavior. And they have an expectation that before we make a claim, the claim is checked by independent people who are outside of the system who are equally qualified to verify that that claim is right. The other thing is it gives you a decentralized brain. You know, when I talk about 900 citations for the GKL paper, that means 900 groups of scientists read the paper and thought that it was connected in some way to what they were doing and cited it. And here's what happens. Those teams call you. They talk to you. They say, did you think about this? Do you think about that? Like, we created Ouroboros. And some academics out of Stanford and UIUC, they created a variant of it called Nakamoto Proof of Stake. It was actually a problem we wanted to solve. We were a little like, ah, damn, we wish we would have written that paper. But now that that's part of the commons, I get that for free. Okay, I don't have to invent that myself. And there are certain people in academia who you cannot talk to in a commercial sense. Like a great example would be Adi Shamir, the S in RSA. He's crazy fucking rich. He's got hundreds of millions of dollars. You can't call up Adi and be like, Adi, you need to come work for me. He'll be like, ah, I'm an old man. But you know, he's super academically engaged still. And so if you want to go talk to Adi, it's easy. You go to an academic conference that he happens to be at, and he'll talk to you. I was on a panel with the guy. He asked me about proof of stake. It was a great moment. And so you want to not only have a decentralized brain and get rid of the cult of personality, but then you also want to be able to talk to people that you can only talk to in that particular setting. And a corollary to that is that it makes it truly universal, because universities are everywhere. You can invite Ethiopian universities. You can invite Korean universities. You can invite everybody. So even if I can't do business there or there's no commercial viability there, there's smart people there. And what you do is you go and say, hey, give me those smart people. Here are my papers. And now you have a lingua franca where you can communicate with those people. And then they can ask you questions and show you things and so forth. And so I felt it was so incredibly important, because if these protocols really are going to be the next big thing, they are going to run your life. They're going to be in charge of your identity, your privacy, your bank account, your payment system. They're going to be in charge of the way you vote. They're going to be in charge of the deed for your house and all these types of things. Why in God's name would you entrust a 25-year-old kid in Silicon Valley with this move fast and break thing idea to burden you for the next 40 years with a horrible system? Why don't we do things right? We have the luxury of doing it. We haven't quite hit that network effect yet, especially if doing things right doesn't slow you down too much. And the greatest example, I've already won on this, Ethereum Polkadot Cardano. Ethereum has been at the proof of stake game a year longer than we have. We shipped proof of stake first, despite the fact that we did it peer review. Polkadot used Ouroboros, our protocol, as their starting point for their ecosystem. So our primary competitors either copy us or took longer to get to market, despite the fact that they were following a move fast and break things mentality. So you spend a lot more time up front, but because you are building on Granite and they're compositional, every protocol layer is on top of the next protocol, you actually have a huge hockey stick of acceleration on the back end. And then you end up getting much better protocols, and they're transnational instead of around a cult of personality around an individual or a company. And if you're truly committed to decentralization, I think that's actually the only way to get there long term.
Huh, fascinating. I'm wondering if we can dive into Cardano more specifically, how it kind of solves the limitations and the challenges of second generation blockchains and where this is headed. Your Cardano site says, Cardano is an open platform that seeks to provide economic identity to billions who lack it by providing decentralized applications to manage identity, value, and governance. So the two things I want you to ask you about is, number one, economic identity. Can you kind of expound on that? And number two, managing identity, value, and governance. What's the point? What's the value proposition to the regular person? Why do they need decentralized apps to manage their identity, value, and governance?
Yeah, let's get into that. It's a great question. So economic identity is one of those things that we have it until you don't. And when you don't, it's like water. You die without it. You desperately need it. So, you know, it's hard for people who grow up in America or in the developed world who have passports and driver's license and social security numbers and bank accounts and insurance. And when they need to get a loan, they can get a loan. It's there. But then, you know, when you take those things away from people, they say, holy hell, you know, how do I get ahead? Like, let's say you have this brilliant business idea. Where do you go to get capital for it? Let's say you say, hey, if I had a car, I could get a job in the big city and I could pay you back over a 5-10 year period and we both benefit. You make some interest. That can't do that arrangement. It just doesn't exist. There's all these farmers who, if they could mechanize in Africa, they'd have massive yield improvements. But there's no place to go to get that mechanization or that fertilizer or whatever they need. So they lack economic identity in certain respects. And this is exacerbated by globalization, because now not only can they not do business the way we do business in our own economy, they can't do business globally because you have counterparty risk. Somebody says, look, I'll be a programmer. You say, great. Well, show me your credentials. I went to this university in Guadalajara, or this university in Senegal, or this university here. It's like, I don't really know if that's good or bad. I said, show me your work references. Well, I work for all these local companies. I don't know anything about those local companies. I don't know if this guy's really the guy to hire. And then how do you pay him? What if 15, 20, 30% of your salary is absorbed just moving the money to pay the person? This is a reality that billions of people exist with and live with. And even if they do get some money, what happens when a war breaks out? What happens when monsoons come or an act of God comes, a force majeure event? They have no insurance. And so they can't protect those things. And so even a windfall can be quickly taken away from people. Good governance, good systems, good institutions, they protect the average, not the extremes. They bring the poor up and they take a little bit from the rich to make sure that there's enough value for everyone. So there's a rising tides effect. And if you live in a place without economic identity, it's because your systems don't promote it. So my conjecture is that this is not something that government has to give you. This is something a market can give you. And if you have a private protocol, the protocol may be able to carry that. So for example, there's the DID standard, the centralized identifier. That's for self-sovereign identity. Why is it the government has to be the one that gives you a passport? Why is it Equifax has to be the one that says you're creditworthy or something like that? Why can't we just create some new concept that you control, and through your interactions organically and references from other people in the system over time, you can build credibility and you own that. That's your credential. You can't be shut out from this type of a system. So that's economic identity in a certain respect. When you talk about value, why is it that value is just controlled by a bank? If you piss off the local regime, they can push a button and then suddenly you've been unbanked and you have no access to your money. What's the first thing the U.S. government does when they arrest someone and it's a white collar crime? They freeze their accounts. You could be a billionaire and then suddenly have no access to your billions of dollars and then still have to defend yourself against the government. So no matter who you are, you could be shut out. Look at Jack Ma in China. He ran afoul of the communist regime. He's the richest, one of the most powerful people in China. And they basically say, you're just going to disappear for 3 months and go play golf. And we don't want to see you right now. So, yes, sir. And if he really rocks the boat, he's going to be thrown in prison and charged with one of those death sentence crimes. Because that's the point. The system, it's like oligarchs in Russia. If you're good with Putin, you're doing great. You fall out with Putin, you could be a $15 billion richest guy in jail, charged with tax evasion, right? So economic identity is not just about do you have it or not. It's also about what is the rule of law and the terms and conditions behind how you preserve and keep your value. And is it fair? And can, for political reasons, people come and take these things from you? And then finally, governance is all about how do you make decisions? Corporations are terrible in a certain respect. You know, you have the CEO at the top, and if they're a brilliant visionary leader like a Musk or a Jobs, you feel very privileged. But most people, they work for idiots. They work for systems that have momentum. And, you know, like, God, the old glory days of our company are long behind us. Like, how dreary is it to be an HP employee? Or an IBM employee? It's like we all experience this in our lives. That's why people start companies, because they get so tired of working for that. Well, what if you make decisions from the bottom up instead of the top down? What if there's no CEO? What if it's a cooperative instead? What if the brightest people, the most meritocratic people, have the ability to rise to the top, as opposed to the people who happen to be related to somebody or the largest shareholder or something like that? So the point of Cardano is saying, well, all that stuff requires protocols. It requires you a place to put the money, to put the identity, and to put these governance voting systems and so forth. And that's expensive normally. And also, it's usually not transnational. And usually, there's some guy in charge, your company in charge, your government in charge. So we say, let's make sure that we can do all those things, much more things than what Bitcoin does or even Ethereum does, but do that in the lowest possible way, equal access to all. And it required us to build a lot of new stuff. Like, we had to come up with a new engine. So we built Ouroboros and we did the whole proof of stake thing, and it gets more decentralized over time and faster over time. We had to come up with a new way of doing transactions. So we created extended UTXO and Plutus and Marlowe and, you know, all this other stuff. We had to create a new way of doing governance. So we created Catalyst and so forth. And so along the way, we just had to keep adding things. And these are starting points. And, in, you know, if you build the right system, they evolve. And if you have the right evolutionary factors, over time, they'll grow into that vision of something that no matter how poor you are, where you happen to live, there's a way for you to access this thing. And once you access it, you have the same set of tools as the richest man in the world. There's never been a time in human history where systems existed that could offer you that value proposition.
Mm-hmm. When I hear your explanation, but also stuff that's going on with decentralized, let's say, finance, mm-hmm. et cetera, it strikes me as a little bit of an alternative universe, of an alternative economic universe, that it's almost like a different dimension in a way, a different mm-hmm. alternative reality, where people are actually creating an entire economy that businesses and products and services can be exchanged. But when I hear kind of your thing about economic identity, it also sounds like, okay, wait, the centralized traditional economy has failed a large group of people by not being fair or efficient, not providing the simple tools that people need to transact in this, let's say, physical world traditional economy. But even that, the economy is still unfair, inefficient, et cetera. But now there's the beginnings of a completely different universe of, it's an alternative economic universe where you can have fair identity. You can have the tools. It could be an efficient system. It's not rigged against just certain people, but it's equal opportunity. And potentially, I mean, do you think this decentralized infrastructure economy, do you think this will run the majority of economic value in the world? And if you do think that, when do you think that tipping point kind of happens in the future?
Well, you know, it's always crazy until you remember that we've seen it happen multiple times already in our lifetime. I mean, first with the software industry, when Bill Gates told his parents, hey, I'm dropping out of Harvard to go do software. They're like, are you selling shoes? What is software? What is this? Like, no, it's like digital code that runs on a computer. What's a computer? Those giant things? No. They're going to get small. They're going to be personal computers. But trust me, this software thing is going to be people are going to pay real money for something that you can infinitely replicate. And we're going to create artificial scarcity within it. It's going to be a whole industry. Trust me. It's like, it was a crazy concept. But now it's just like, oh yeah, software industry. There's tens of millions of people in it. And then the internet, they were like, oh yeah, you know, we're just going to get involved in this industry that requires everybody to like get something installed in their home. And then they're going to spend many meaningful hours of their lives on something called a web browser and freely exchange massive amounts of information about themselves. And they're going to buy stuff and vote and do all this stuff online. It's like, you're fucking crazy. Like when Elon Musk was pitching this with his brother, when they had their company Zip2, I think it was 94, they had a guy throw a phone book at him and say, are you telling me that your company is going to replace this? And Elon's like, yes. It's like, get out of here. You're crazy. I know. It's like, and we think that story is so insane, but go to YouTube and look at like 60 Minutes when they're talking about the internet in the early 90s and how they're describing it, what they're saying. It's just like, these people are so stupid. But at the time, we all thought that way. And then we saw it again with cell phones. And like, oh yeah, everybody's just going to carry computers in their pocket that are always online. I mean, we have whole businesses built on the fact that cell phones exist. Before 2007, no one could have possibly imagined the power of smartphones. So we are amazing as humans, every 10, 20 years, reinventing things. And usually it either comes from getting lucky or some event that forces people. So in the case of the rise of the internet, you had kind of the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, Moore's law was really the carrier of the invention of the transistor for the semiconductor industry and the personal computer industry. And then, in the case of cryptocurrencies, they were born of a loss of faith in financial institutions. I mean, it was like embedded from the Genesis block of Bitcoin, like the Chancellor bailout. So then we look at today, we say there's the Great Reset. COVID has devastated the entire world. And people, vast majority of people, no matter where they fall politically, say, the world fucked up with COVID. It should not happen this way. You know, millions of people are starving to death because of it. Millions of people have died of it. No one has acted well. And so there's this great reset that's happening, whatever the hell that means. And there's an appetite now for completely new systems. And if somebody comes and says, maybe you have more say in the way your world works, they come to you and say, maybe you don't have to trust the government and you get a better quality of service and you can fire people if they don't do the job. There's an appetite for that. People are very excited about it. Now, where I believe it's going to take root first are in the places that are in the greatest crisis. So the developing world is obvious to focus on, because whenever they go into a global depression, they're the ones who starve first. And when people are starving in an age where information flows instantaneously, your leaders get replaced really quickly. And the new guys that come in and gals that come in, they have to change it. And they don't change it by saying, let's do more of the same. They change it by saying, let's do something else. And they go for the crazy ideas. And some of those crazy ideas actually work, like blockchain or something like that. And then somehow they win. And when they win, that means their nation becomes significantly wealthier. And then all these Western companies are saying, holy shit, we need to adapt. Because if we don't, these guys are going to eat our lunch. And so then they go and lobby for laws to change, society to change, to become interoperable with the new systems that are there. Just like, for example, newspapers, they said, hey, this internet thing is really scary. We shouldn't just pretend it's going to go away. Let's figure out how to get online productively. And the New York Times figured out how to do that. The Rocky Mountain News didn't. And that's why the New York Times is still around. And the Rocky Mountain News went out of business.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's fascinating because, I guess the underdeveloped world as a catch-on. I hear you have an announcement or something you're waiting for with Africa, right? There might be a nation state that might be making an announcement regarding Cardano. So I'm super excited about this. is any moment, any day, or it's sometime maybe this month, right? That's what the bird says.
Yeah, well, that's what we're hoping. That bird keeps talking, but some of it already leaked, and that's why we announced a little bit of it. But it involves 5 million people, and it's probably the most significant deal we've ever done as a company. And it's going to be a lot of fun when we announce it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing stuff. I want to move into the developer community. How important do you think is the developer community to build and to foster around Cardano? And what specific things, for example, are you doing to bring them in? But more specifically, what's the key value proposition you're presenting to them? Like, why develop their dApps on Cardano versus another blockchain?
Yeah, you know, what's so extraordinary is Consensus is a great marketer, and they've convinced people of the inevitability of Ethereum. There's only 80,000 Solidity developers out of a total of 22.6 million developers in the world. So don't tell me they have a network effect. Second, 31% of new dApps were deployed on Ethereum. The other 69% were not, according to State of the dApps. So obviously, in 2020, so obviously they're losing their network effect, and they haven't achieved it by the totality of all developers. So it's an open game, and you know, it's kind of weird. Like, people just don't get how business works. Look, if you want to get a lot of guys to come to your club, you need to show that you have hot women at your club. And then a lot of guys will come. It's that obvious, right? So similarly, when you're writing applications, you have to say, hey, there's value here. If you build apps on this platform, you'll find customers. So what are we doing? We're running around Africa making multi-million person deals, and we talk about DeFi. Who do you think is the more valuable DeFi customer? The 25-year-old yield farmer in New Jersey who has no protocol loyalty, or the person that relies upon loans from that platform for their entire livelihood? You know, so you say, if there's a platform that's committed to bringing tens of millions of DeFi customers who will be using this 24/7 as their entire center of their economic identity versus the fair-weather yield farmer, I'd probably want to develop on that platform, because you know that's the one that's here to stay. And that's the one that's going to grow like a weed, and it's going to have billions of dollars of demand very quickly on it. So that's one dimension of it. And, you know, the other dimension is just common sense. It's like EVM is not proprietary. So we added it. If you have Solidity code or EVM code, it works on Cardano. We call this the island, the ocean, and the pond. So that's the pond. It's the crazy Cambrian pond that Vitalik created. Then second, we have this beautiful new programming language called Plutus that allows you to write certified and high assurance applications. These are the kinds of things that if they fail, people die or billions of dollars are lost. So we talk about enterprise adoption and, you know, Fortune 500 adoption. They don't care about first to market. They already have a market. How many customers does Microsoft have? If they screw up, it costs them far more than whatever wild entrepreneurial adventurism is giving them. So they care about correctness. They care about it not blowing up. They care about making sure that no one gets fired. So when you talk about formal methods and high assurance certified software, that's how you win there. So all the peer review, all the formal method stuff we've done, that whole strategy we have there, it's very appealing to Fortune 500 adoption, enterprise adoption, and it's unique in that respect. And then the ocean is C#, .NET, Java, JavaScript. Those three alone are over 10 million developers. They make Solidity look like a toy. So have a path so that people who develop there can develop for your ecosystem and the tools and languages that they already know. And we partnered with one of the greatest firms in the world for that, runtime verification, and they found a way to do it with something called Yella. So over a period of time, we can bring these mainstream programming languages in for your off-chain and your on-chain infrastructure, and lo and behold, you can build all kinds of great applications. But in general, you know, when you think about developers, I call it ACIDIC as the strategy. So what it stands for is developer acquisition, developer collaboration, developer incentives, application deployment, application interactions, and application curation. You have to have all of these end-to-end if you want to be truly a great platform for people to come in. So usually we're talking about developer acquisition, but that's more about the facts and circumstances around your ecosystem. Even if it's hell to develop on your ecosystem, developers will still do it if there's the right ecosystem. No greater example than Nintendo. When you built original Nintendo games, you had to write assembly code. It was like the worst experience in the world, but people did it because the customers were there. So they'll be willing to endure a lot of pain. And I'm not saying we have that. In fact, it's the opposite. We've tried to give people a glass of ice water in hell. That's one thing about acquisition. Second, collaboration is, what are you doing with them? Is it static or is it active? Static is just like, here's a book, here's a tutorial, here's some documentation. Good luck, everybody. Active is, here's where you go to ask questions and we'll actually answer them. Active can be, we're going to read your pull requests and help you with those things. Active, we're going to co-develop the application with you, or we could build parts of the application for you. And also, what is the platform providing you? If you issue a token on Cardano, it's treated the same as ADA. And at some point, you'll be able to pay your transaction fees in that token. Can you do that with Ethereum? No, not at all. Never. It'd never be that way, but it's just the way it is with native assets with us. Second, all those voting systems we have for voting with ADA, you can reuse them because your asset's treated the same as ADA to vote for your thing. So when your MakerDAO suffering a class action lawsuit because of a short squeeze in March of last year, and you're like, God, how do we build a proper DAO because we hate getting sued? Well, why don't you just borrow some of our governance stuff? And suddenly you don't have to figure out how to build a voting system. So you don't have to figure out how to build a DAO. The network gives that to you. Huzzah, hallelujah. Then you think about regulation. You need identity. You need KYC. You need AML. You need all these things. Well, we have a product called Prism that we've built. You can embed a DID into your transaction, into your application, and these types of things. Makes it a lot easier to think about the regulatory reality and comply with laws. Okay, so that's the collaboration side. And then the incentives, we have Catalyst. There's going to be $200 million plus money available this year for funding. That is decentralized VC. So you can submit a ballot and the community can vote on it. We've already given away $250,000. Next round going on right now, fund three is $1 million, and it just will keep growing. So the money's there. Then in terms of application deployment, interaction, collaboration, we're building an app store. And we're going to make it really easy for people to deploy applications to it. And so it's one-click install for all these dApps. Just obvious stuff, acidic. And it's not, you know, rocket science. We saw Apple do this. We saw Android do this. You know, we saw Microsoft do this. There's 30 plus years of history in the internet world and 50 years of history in the software world about what you need to do to get things where they need to go. And yeah, the developer is certainly an important part, but it's also the ecosystem around it and the belief that that ecosystem is going to get strong that gets people there. Remember, when the iPhone started, it had 0% market share. And just people forget that, you know, and it's like, oh, you're going to go and overcome a 3 billion person network effect with Windows? You're nuts. Ballmer was laughing. All these other guys were laughing. But the thing was that the iPhone did things that the other guys couldn't do. That's the final point. Make sure that your platform does something that other people can't do. And the fact that it has built-in governance and built-in identity and the native asset standards, none of our competitors really have that. The other thing is we have access to markets that none of our competitors have access to. And that is what brings that first wave of people and their success brings the next wave of people, and their success brings the next wave of people, and so forth. So it's not rocket science. You just have to be a good historian, and you have to really think carefully about the pieces of the ecosystem.
Okay. With regulation, we have Janet Yellen, the new Treasury Secretary, who's going to be influential, let's say, in her decisions on how she chooses to push regulation through with crypto or not. I noticed with Cardano, you guys have been thinking about, you know, the ability to, you know, form a bridge between the traditional, let's say, finance world through having some type of, let's say, metadata or KYC info in as an option, let's say, to put into the blockchain for certain transactions. I'm curious your thoughts on that. It seems like there's a conflict where the anonymity of certain blockchains and crypto poses some type of threat to the existing financial, let's say, legacy systems or to the government. But to compromise, can you bridge the gap without compromising anonymity? Or do you have to make sacrifices with anonymity?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting philosophical question. So when you look at a transaction in general, that's kind of the heart. That's the unit of these systems, the transaction. There's kind of five properties to it. So first, you know, the transactions carry units of value. And so what you're carrying on that rail has a lot to say with the regulation. So if it's security, that's a whole different thing than a loyalty point or, you know, a crypto kitty or something like that. So there's first the value. Then second, there's the actors involved. So the identity of the people. So those actors and, you know, what they're doing and where they happen to be at has a lot to do with the regulation on the rail. Then you have the metadata. So that's when did it happen? Where did it happen? And in many cases, that's as important or more important than the transaction. And when people don't believe me about that, I say, okay, I'll give you two identical transactions, identical people, different metadata. $300 ATM withdrawal at 11:30 in the afternoon next to an Italian restaurant. $300 ATM withdrawal at 1:30 at night next to a brothel. Same guy. Do you think that metadata is relevant for the context of the nature of the transaction? And which one would you tell your wife? So you know, metadata is super important. And actually, cryptocurrencies have very little to say about that historically because it tends to be outside of the transaction and maintained by centralized servers and malleable. So even if your transaction is there, the metadata may actually be manipulatable. And then you have the contractual understanding. So why are you doing what you're doing? What is the relationship between these parties? Is this a donation? Is this a purchase? Is this a joint venture? That's what the smart contract does. And then finally, all of those four things live within some notion of regulation, okay? So there's some idea, implicit or explicit, of what is legal, what is illegal, based upon the facts and circumstances of those four things. The metadata, the identity, the types of assets you're doing, and the people who are involved in the geographies that they happen to be in. The power of cryptocurrencies is you can embed into the transaction a lot of programmability to automatically comply with regulations. And this does not necessarily mean that you have to give up all your privacy or allow the government to be completely in control. In many cases, they don't want to be. It's just they have a mandate and there are certain geopolitical or consumer protection realities that they live with. And they say, well, we'd like to understand some things. So, for example, probably in the next 3 years, we're going to see, because of FATF and the Treasury Department, a strong push to embed identity to wallets and to transactions. Now, that can be done with a DID, signing a wallet, and that can be done with a DID flying with the transaction and being signed by the transaction. Now, here's the thing. You can encrypt that. So that DID is indistinguishable or unlinkable, so you still are pseudonymous, but you can share the decryption with the parties involved and the regulator. So there you have universal privacy, so everybody on the outside has no idea what's going on, but then you, for the relevant jurisdictions, the relevant parties and companies, they have more data about the transaction than others. So that concept of escalation, regulatory escalation, without losing things in a universal sense is an underexplored area. And I think it's going to become the dominant way of doing business. I already tell you one area where it would actually not only be beneficial, it would add consumer protection. So exchanges, when you withdraw your funds, when they do KYC with you, they should do KYC to a DID. Then, because that DID has cryptographic credentials independent of your account, what they can do is say, we're only going to withdraw to an address you sign with your DIT. Now, this DIT is only KYC to the exchange. So everybody on the outside has no clue who that account belongs to, but Binance or Bittrex or these other guys know they have a chain of custody now verifying that. Well, here's the beautiful thing. If a hacker compromises your account on Binance or Bittrex, they can't withdraw because they don't have your private key for your DID. It's a separate credential that's separate from you. I recently did a video about Twitter where it went after the big Twitter hack happened and Bill Gates' account got hacked and all these other guys. What caused the problem was the God Mode admin panel that allowed them to reset passwords and then they could get access to Obama and Bill Gates and all this other stuff. Well, what if every time you tweet, you have to sign your tweet with a DID? That DID's not controlled by Twitter, so I could take over your account, but I could never tweet a verified tweet. So that's an example of an escalation point where you can KYC something, it's to a particular business domain or regulation domain, and it's relevant there, but in general doesn't universally compromise your access to the system because you can always send transactions without it, and it doesn't compromise your privacy because that linkability is only preserved by the relevant parties. And then if you're doing business with regulated actors and regulated jurisdictions, it's a cost of doing business. If you do business in China, they're going to want to know what your butt hair looks like. If you do business in Seychelles, they don't want to know what you look like.
Got it. With regulation, do you think it favors those who can innovate more quickly versus the blockchains that maybe are slower going, or maybe the blockchains that anonymity poses perhaps a bigger part of the value proposition? For example, if there's a lot of utility outside of just anonymous transactions or anonymous store of value, then perhaps, and you move fast with your blockchain technologies, you're able to, maybe regulation doesn't hit you as much, but do you think there's certain blockchains that are more vulnerable to regulations or not?
Well, I mean, there's always that question. You know, Brendan Ick was recently on Lex Fridman's podcast, and he talked about this idea that the wrong way is the right way. You know, oftentimes in technology, it wasn't the right thing that won. It was the wrong thing that won because they moved faster. And then it was just a game of managing it and eventually fixing it over a period of time. JavaScript is probably the greatest example of that. But I don't believe that's the case for the cryptocurrency space at all, because these protocols are highly regulated at the end of the day. You know, even if they're not directly regulated, because they touch regulated activities, there's always going to be these factors that slow you down. You move too quickly, you get hit with a regulatory action that puts you out of business. So you can only kind of move at a certain pace. And then the other thing is that the technologies are not settled. It would be like one thing if there was a super scalable, awesome protocol, but it was 90% there. But we don't have that. They're all replicated systems. So even if you're wildly successful, like Ethereum or Bitcoin, you grow until you can't, and then you collapse. You know, MySpace ran into this issue. Their infrastructure and model was only built in a way that they could reach a certain peak. And then after that peak, they could not grow beyond it. The quality of service fell apart. The product fell apart. And that's where we're at with Bitcoin and Ethereum. And it's why it's a race to build a third generation. Now, once you achieve a network, true network effect with billions of users, you will become like Google. Even if you try to pull a Microsoft and spend $15 billion on Bing and buy tons of companies, you probably won't chip away too much at that that standard. So I do believe that some of the old rules still apply, but I also do believe we haven't gotten to that network effect level where they are actually going to apply quite yet. I still think it's quite fertile ground for, you know, a lot of people to compete. The other thing is that you're doing different things in different jurisdictions. Who is the number one chain for governance right now? There aren't any. Who's the number one chain for interoperability right now that just works with everything? There aren't any. Who's the number one chain for scalability and high throughput transactions right now? There aren't any. And yeah, you'll get all these, you know, well-intended but misguided people come to Twitter and say, oh, but my protocol, Hashgraph, or this protocol, it has all of these things. Like, great, I'm glad you read infographics and marketing material and you believe that so much you're willing to trade your house for it. Good for you. But let's be honest here. The reason we did things the way we did is we were actually curious if such a thing existed. Because if it did, I wouldn't build it. I just take it and start building on top of it. I started with Bitcoin, and I left Bitcoin not because I was pushed out. I left Bitcoin because there was no way to use Bitcoin to do the things that I wanted to do. So I had to go and find, you know, higher tides somewhere else. And then we did Ethereum. And then Ethereum can't do, and Vitalik Buterin himself is the first to admit it, because he's building Ethereum too. And Ethereum can't do the things that we need it to do. So we're, you know, all building a different thing. And then somebody's eventually going to get that thing. And then it's less important about the underlying infrastructure at that point. And it's far more important about the applications and the people. That's the, like, no one really cares about the web browser much anymore. They care a lot more about the website. They care more a lot about the web application, mm-hmm. right?
One of my viewers on Twitter or YouTube was asking, do you hold any Bitcoin or Ethereum?
I've never had Ether. I gave away all my Ether. I didn't know if it was going to work or not, and I gave it all to my secretary. I said, well, I don't know if this thing is going to be good or not. So when I was entitled to 293,000 Ether as a Ethereum founder. Wow. At the current price point, I think it's like 500 million. I try not to think about that number, Dave. It's like the multi-million dollar Xbox. I did okay. So I've never had any Ether. Yeah. I've had some Ether Classic. I bought some. Mm-hmm. And I have Ergo, and I have some Poly, because I worked on Poly. And I have Bitcoin and ADA. Those are the cryptocurrencies. Okay.
Got it. Yeah. What was that story about the Apple investor or co-founder that
he had 5%.
Exactly.
And like, he was the tiebreaker, and he just gave it. I can't. Yeah, just here. He gave it back. But, you know, he ended up doing a lot of other stuff, and he made tens of millions of dollars off of it. So they asked him, like, do you regret that? He's like, yeah, you know, I lived a good life.
It's exactly. Okay. With Elon Musk. So Elon Musk made big waves recently with, you know, getting on Twitter with Bitcoin, with Dogecoin, and then Tesla buying $1.5 billion of Bitcoin on their balance sheet. What are your thoughts on this? Do you agree with Elon Musk's move here to go into Bitcoin? What are your thoughts on his tweets on Dogecoin? Ah. I mean, it seems like he's propping this up, but does it even have anything of value, this coin?
He's trolling the Securities Exchange Commission. This is what you do when you're the world's richest man and you're a bit eccentric and you've become Howard Hughes. He'll be saving his urine in no time. Actually, I've met Elon a few times. He used to come to my alma mater back before he was super rich and famous, because he recruited aerospace engineers for SpaceX there. And his brother lives in Boulder. He has a restaurant there mm-hmm. called The Kitchen. Kimball's a really nice guy. But anyway, basically they took a position in Bitcoin. They couldn't go around and be like, yay, Bitcoin, Bitcoin's great. Cause maybe that's market manipulation, right? But if you say, hey, buy Dogecoin, which they don't hold and they have nothing to do with, how do you get Dogecoin? You buy some Bitcoin to buy your Dogecoin. So it actually manipulates the Bitcoin market by manipulating the Dogecoin market, especially for newcomers into the ecosystem. And when they get tired of Dogecoin, what do they sell it into? Bitcoin. They become Bitcoin holders. So if you're cynical, it was a very clever way to boost a thing that he already holds. But on the other hand, maybe he was just trying to prove a point that these markets are very malleable. Who knows? He's a weird guy in that respect. And he's a true genius. And they look at the world fundamentally differently than most people do. And mm-hmm. discerning their motives is kind of like, you know, finding what's funny to Charlie Chaplin. It'll be weird and surprising to you, and you're not funny at all. But somehow to him, it's the funniest joke in the world. So I have no idea. You know, on the other hand, I think what he did do is convince Larry Ellison and a lot of these other guys to start taking Bitcoin into the treasuries of their companies. And Bitcoin is the gateway drug. It's the socially acceptable way. It's almost like the Catholic Church runs everything. So how do you find a way to be an atheist? You know, so you become a church philosopher. And then you could talk about the nature of God. And then you're allowed to write arguments against the nature of God. But you're not an atheist, right? You're just talking around so you can come to the inevitable conclusion that God exists. So similarly, how do you get away from the dollar as a US Fortune 500 company? Well, you buy some Bitcoin, but you're not getting away from the dollar. You're just diversifying your treasury, you know, this type of a deal. So I think that's what we see happening. And it's a super bullish thing for our industry, because the Treasury Department will not be able to regulate cryptocurrencies with a heavy hand, because anything they do to any of the cryptocurrencies will also impact Bitcoin. And mm-hmm. if the Fortune 500s hold it, they own the government. They're just going to say no. And the government will say, okay, we tried.
Awesome. Last question. A viewer asks, what are the best options for retail investors to invest in DeFi? Is it mining, borrowing, buying tokens, or is there a better way to participate in this fast growing market?
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, we're going to build a whole DeFi portfolio for Cardano, but the problem I have with DeFi is, A, a lot of the protocols are built on quicksand. B, they don't have anything there that would make sense from an investable viewpoint. And a lot of them seem like Ponzi schemes. In fact, I think the fifth or sixth most popular dApp on Cosmos is a Ponzi scheme. And they're like public about it. You know, there's just like tons of crazy things in the space about that. And, you know, I'm just skeptical of anything that goes up 100%, down 100% in such a short period of time. It doesn't have a public open team behind it. And also, the protocol was just kind of written over a 2-day period in a basement through a hackathon. Yeah, sometimes you get lucky, but oftentimes that's just a recipe for disaster. And the issue is the economic incentives aren't properly aligned. If it blows up, you're the one who loses. The people who built the protocol usually cashed out already. So they get rich regardless, and they're no longer vested in the success of the system. So it's made me a little skeptical of DeFi. But on the other hand, you know, we are building a portfolio for Cardano. So we're actually starting to think about this, and we have a program that we're doing with runtime verification called Alpha Frontier, where we're systematically formalizing DeFi, like SushiSwap and all this other stuff, and trying to figure out how that stuff works so that we have specs for it. And then we could discern correct protocols from bad protocols. And I'm sure there's plenty of things that, as we're doing that, are actually very exciting and very appealing. So I will have a much stronger opinion about what's good in DeFi probably in about 3 months as we go through that exercise.
Awesome. Charles, it's been fascinating talking with you. I know this year is going to be a big year for Cardano with all the rollouts you have. Would love to catch up to you in like about a year or so to hear an update. But I wanted to wish your YouTube channel the best too. You've been on fire with these live streams. I caught one last week, and the amount of comments are just so fast. I can't even read them. They're just like, it's insane. What's going on here?
They're funny. I mean, I have like almost 200,000 followers now on Twitter, and I think I have like 40, 50,000 subscribers to my YouTube channel. And, you know, I do an AMA. I used to only get like 5,000 people who would watch it. Now I'm getting like 40, 50,000 views. So I'm not quite at the hockey stick yet, but it's getting there, and it's a lot of fun. You know, I love the AMAs. They're so much fun to do.
Awesome. Any story to your alpaca blanket there or
Oh,
poncho?
yeah, I'm getting. I have it's -10 outside, right? It's brutally cold. So I'm wearing the alpaca poncho because it's really warm and it's got a hood. So
Got
I kind of
it.
put it over. And then the other thing is I'm getting alpacas for my farm. I have a farm, and I'm getting four alpacas, and so I figure I should get into alpaca culture. So I'm getting used to all things alpaca.
Got it. All right. I'll add links to a bunch of your videos and your Twitter and your YouTube. Any last words you have before we wrap up?
Yeah, you know, one thing that I learned a long time ago from a person who was a computer programmer and a Buddhist monk, as he said to me, Charles, sometimes the slow way is the fast way. And it's one of those Buddhist koans, right? You have to think like, what does that really mean? And I think we've kind of discovered that with the cryptocurrency space. Everything moves super fast, but then things actually move super slow too. And sometimes by just focusing on the core problems and relentlessly attacking them, you make enormous progress, and then you wake up and it's solved. Like Bitcoin came out in 2009. It's been around for over 11 years. It's there. It's a big part of crypto culture, but the promise of Bitcoin has yet to be realized, but it's tantalizingly close. And what we did is we just started, you know, from first principles, and we've walked this insanely slow, methodical journey. And now we have Cardano and everything's turning on. And to me, it kind of feels self-evident that we have found a way to deliver that promise over a period of time. And I encourage more people in the industry to move on from move fast and break things to the slow way is the fast way, and realize that that's the mature way to do things, and that you have in your hands a tremendous responsibility. This technology, if we get it right, as I mentioned, will probably end up being in charge of people's lives in no small manner. And you know, we last year had Vint Cerf come to our summit, the Shelley Summit in July, and he was the creator of the internet. He created TCP/IP, and the topic of the panel was 40 years later, knowing what you know now, what would you have done differently? And he's like, well, let's write a book, let's talk about it. And he was just going on and on and on about all the problems with the internet, and look at all the problems we have: passwords and usernames, all the hacking, the identity theft, scams, these types of things, because of the way the internet was designed. On one hand, he got things fabulously well, but all the mistakes that they made have created so many problems for us. So what I'd like to do is live in a world where things that are even more meaningful to our lives, like how you pay your mortgage and, you know, your land deed and so forth, that's built well, and we don't have the same set of complaints. And so maybe the slow way is the fast way. And with Cardano, we seem to be delivering on that promise. We keep getting bigger and we never give up ground. And I hope next year we're twice as big or three times as big as we are this year. And it'd be great to do an interview with you.
Awesome. Thanks, Charles. I appreciate it. And yeah, have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
Here's David.
All right. Thanks.